What's that?
Welcome back to the Afoot podcast, a mystery genre podcast in which we talk about anything that involves, well, either a dead body, a parlor, or some kind of footprints in the mud outside the window. And joining me this week are three intrepid guests who are going to talk with me about the most, the kind of noiriest of all noir things, the Maltese Falcon. I'm Glenn Fleischman, a fact not previously established but now known, your host, regular host of the show. And joining me to talk about Maltese Falcon, the book and movie and B-movies, are Dylan McConis, a cartoonist from Portland, Oregon. Dylan, how are you?
Hi. I'm quite well, Glenn. Thank you for asking.
It is wonderful to have you here. And from just slightly north, James Callan, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm very
I guess
well.
We just went over that. Sorry.
Well, I'll continue to be. It might change. You never know.
Okay.
This is a mystery show. And then from the Great Eastern Shore is Brock Winstead from Oakland. Brock, how are you?
Doing well, Glenn. Hello. Hello, Glenn, and other afooties, afootists, afooters, afeet? What are we
afeet.
Collectively?
Afeetians. Brock suggested this podcast, so you had to be on. You have to be on because he suggested the podcast. But, we've talked in the past. We've been doing some larger overview episodes, and this one is very specific. Is if you haven't read The Maltese Falcon or seen the classic Humphrey Bogart movie, then you may either want to go read and watch them and come back, or recognize that for something that was written in the 1930s and the adaptation we're going to be talking about primarily filmed in 1941, there will be spoilers in this podcast. I have to believe that everyone born in the last 70 or 80 years probably just knows the plot because it's like such a part of literature. And we're actually talking about, I'm talking with a couple other podcast people about maybe doing a Maltese Falcon rip-off mashup episode about all the other things that are based on Maltese Falcon, because there's so many. I have some people who may be takers for that.
I think that people, and we can talk about this in a bit, I think people know this, people know the Maltese Falcon, but knowing the plot is maybe a separate question, because the plot, as we probably will talk about, has a lot of, wait, what happens now kind of moments.
It's pretty twisty.
Yeah, it's got two big reveals, which I like. I mean, right there in that last bit. So, and it's one of those things that I remember I first read it, a long time ago now. it's good 20 years, more than 20 years. And it was one of those, right, I knew the vaguest, not even vague, I knew the outlines, I knew, character names and everything like that. But then going through the plot again, it was like, oh, yeah. That's what happens here, and that's right. What happens here. Yes, I mean the nuances are easy to forget.
It's great because it's got a very easy central thing. Is there's this bird? There's something special, a bird statuette. There's something special about it. People will kill to get it, and it's worth a lot of money. There you go, boom. there's our story. I want to start out with some before we get into this too far. Two things. First, Dylan, tell us how to correctly pronounce the author's name of this book.
It is Dashiell Hammett, contrary to the common pronunciation of Dashiell, and it comes from his mother's maiden name, and her family was French, so it is pronounced Dashiell, and apparently he hated it when people pronounced it Dashiell.
Oh my goodness, this was such an exciting thing to learn about, because I had no idea. I've been pronouncing it wrong my whole life. So this is
I'm wonderful. Still yes. Reeling from this information.
It's a little known fact.
I think we're going to have like a jar with everybody puts a quarter in if they mispronounce mm-hmm. it on the podcast.
Yeah.
Dylan will not pay anything. And
it's
I will
it's the Dashiell cash.
I have to explain that I have a tactical advantage here, which is that there's literally not been a time in my life where I did not know the plot to the Maltese Falcon or how to pronounce Dashiell Hammett's name. My parents, in fact, have a piece of art I drew at the age of 4 depicting the Maltese Falcon, where I wrote Maltese Falcon underneath it. And yes, I did spell Maltese correctly. Mm. I come from a very hardcore Bogart family. So this stuff is just written into my genetic code.
An advantage I wish I shared.
I dig it. Well, you said that Bogart was like an uncle, I guess, who didn't actually, you never met him, but he was so present in your life growing up.
Yeah, no, there's an entire room in my parents' house dedicated just to Humphrey Bogart memorabilia. And there was my They would have an open house every Friday night. All the friends would come over. And once a month, there would be a Bogart movie and potluck evening.
That sounds really great. I like that.
Yeah.
My parents were fine. I've got no objections. We did not have a Bogart room. I'm just going to say, we did not have a Bogart room.
My dad has a beautiful replica Maltese Falcon. At Christmas time, it gets a little Santa hat put on it.
How are you sure?
Yeah, all sorts of stuff.
How sure are you it's a replica is my question.
That is the exciting question, isn't it? And the actual film prop has a history of being stolen.
Oh, that's excellent. You know what's funny about this plot? We'll go through it. But my impression is, didn't Hammett invent this idea out of whole cloth? There is no historical Maltese Falcon, right?
It's pretty much BS.
It's great, right, though, because it's so
rich. It's a beautiful
so
tapestry of lies.
Yeah, it's so well told. It just sounds like I always assumed that I'm looking into it. I'm like, oh, no, he just made this up, but wonderful. I mean, it's so plausible, every aspect of it at a certain level. And the other is, boy, does this feel Indiana Jones-like at some level.
Oh,
like,
yeah. This is the progenitor for, it feels like the progenitor for a lot of things, not just detective noir fiction, but an approach to kind of antiquities as plot devices and a lot of other tropes, in a sense, that we all can read in other cultural products around us.
I totally agree with that. And it's just a wonderful, I don't know, it's just, everything about it is wonderful. And I'd forgotten how wonderful it was. So it was great to go through it. Well, let's go through the plot of the book first, and then we can talk about adaptations, and particularly the Bogart adaptation is the main thing we'll talk about. But what we can trade off plot points here, but this is why it seems like you're walking into a world that was already created. That's why it's hard to believe. We were talking before the podcast started, because I had to confirm this, that Sam Spade only appears in this Hammett novel and in three short stories. And it feels like someone who's 60 books has written about it. I'm a big Nero Wolfe fan. And, you know, Wolfe, I think there are like 50-something books that involve Nero Wolfe. And this is it. You walk in, he's got a partner, he's got an office, he's got a setup. The cops all know him. There's a history with the cops. There's, you know, years and years before and what seems to be years after, the way the plot, you know, ends.
Yeah.
And this is it. It's amazing.
And that the name somehow floats high above the genre and, you know, giant lights shining on it as if there is an incredible canon of Sam Spade stories, but there really isn't.
Honestly, I don't know. My familiarity is mostly with the production history of the movie, but I do get the impression that just general short fiction paid better.
Mm. Right.
Yeah. I think that might be true. It's more reliable. You knew what you were getting.
Yeah, he also really wrote the Sam Spade stuff quite towards the end of his biggest writing period. So, like, if you look up his production history, most of his short stories were published in the 20s to mid-30s. So I think part of it is just that Sam Spade appeared fairly late in his career.
And he had a big lacuna. I was just looking this up because I'd forgotten. He didn't write anything between,
The Thin Man, yeah.
Yeah, the 1934 and 1961.
He was writing screenplays, so he did at least, I think he did a couple of the Thin Man screenplays, so he definitely went into Hollywood writing a little bit.
Yeah, but I think people paid him to do stuff, but he didn't do anything, is my understanding. He was part of that amazing crowd. I mean, we're talking about the pronunciation of DeShield. It was a famous line, is Dorothy Parker and he were somewhere and someone said, Dot, where's Dash? I think it's the witty Algonquin line about them. But they were all heavy drinkers. I think some of them, the drink took more of a toll than others. I think he was one of them. I was also remembering, too, I forget, that Raymond Chandler, Philip Marlowe, owes a debt to Sam Spade. And so you can read on, not a continuous line, but I would keep thinking about The Big Sleep. Wasn't Sam Spade in that? No, that's Philip Marlowe. You know, what about, oh, yeah, that's right.
It does feel like it blends together at some point.
Yeah, I'd forgotten, or I hadn't realized, I think, explicitly that Philip Marlowe is basically 10 years after Sam Spade. Like, the first Philip Marlowe novel is 10 years later than The Maltese Falcon.
He's waiting
and
for him
feel
to give up
like,
the character.
In my head, they feel contemporary, but...
I just, in January, sat down intentionally to read a bunch of these noir classics that I'd never read. I'd seen movies, things like that, but never read The Maltese Falcon, never read a bunch of the Philip Marlowe any of the Philip Marlowe books, and they really do feel like they're all of a piece. And I had to kind of force myself to remember that they were happening at different time periods, and I mean, not just different physical locations, but in different generations. But they do see they convey a sort of similar tone that makes it seem like they're happening in this universe together.
Because part of it is there's so many relationships. So Sam Spade is clearly, he's a ladies' man, but it's unclear why, because there's nothing in his character that would indicate that anyone would be interested in him. But I guess that's the mystery of...
Yes,
part of the mystery.
He has a way with women. Specifically, he pushes them away once he's done using them.
It's true.
He is described as looking pleasantly like a blonde Satan. So,
and his
maybe...
eyes flicker with uncanny light several times throughout there. So that Satan metaphor keeps going.
Also, he calls women angel a lot, which seems related.
Yes.
Precious. He says precious.
He's a demon. They're an angel.
He's a collection of sharp V's.
Right. The V. I was trying to pick, like, there's a lot of eye action, a lot of lit up eye action.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Things flashing and so forth.
It is very interesting to read the description, knowing that Bogart was the iconic Sam Spade for movies, to read the description of him in the book is like, that does not look anything like Humphrey Bogart, but okay.
6 foot tall, blonde,
yeah, and
broad
blonde
shoulders.
And, you know, this skinny, yeah, okay.
All right, so the story opens. Sam Spade's in his office, and he's talking to, I forget the exact opening of the... of the book, because right away you get the archetype of a beautiful woman walks into the office, right? And it's...
Oh, of course.
Yeah, that's pretty much the start.
Sam's secretary basically comes in.
Effie Perrin, like the moment we start, we don't really know their relationship either. I mean, speaking of all the many relationships, she sort of seems like his girl on the side, but she doesn't seem to have a problem with all the other women either.
She's his gal Friday. His Miss Monty Penny.
She's cool about it, and they have a very comfortable relationship, clearly.
Oh, she's very cool about it. She asks him for nothing over the entire course of the story does everything that he asks.
Yeah,
well, that's what the money is for.
Surprise at the end.
Yeah, exactly.
When we get to the end of the book, the way it diverges from the movie at the end, I think, is really fascinating, especially with her. There's like, you know, novels are supposed to show growth or change, and some people do. So, woman comes in, Miss Wonderly comes in. She has a whole story, and somewhere in the middle of it, Spade's partner, Miles Archer, shows up, and her sister is run off with this woman, Floyd Thursby. She's fears for her sister. She sent a letter to General Delivery. She believes that Thursby is at a certain is going to meet her at a place, and Archer leaps in to volunteer to go out and actually, shadow the guy and tail him.
Because Miss Wonderly is super hot.
Yep,
don't
she's
forget
smoking.
That. Yes.
She's smoking.
So both of the detectives are tongues a wagon.
Yeah, Miles Archer barely manages to peel his tongue off the floor in time to swoop in.
Yeah, he's like a Tex Avery wolf
That's right.
A detective.
It's
And in the film version, he is played by Jerome Cowan with a kind of perfect... overbearing, I'm not even sure what the word is, kind of obvious lust for Wonderly, kind of eagerness to consume her.
Oh, yeah, this the line from the book, this is such a great line of its time. Spade says to him, well, don't dynamite her too much. What do you think of her? And Archer says, sweet. Yeah. And you telling me not to dynamite her. Maybe you saw her first, Sam, but I spoke first. It's so pure. It's like the most period thing. You forget that people actually spoke informally like that.
So Archer agrees. So Archer agrees to keep an eye on her and try to trail this Thursby guy who supposedly has Miss Wonderly's younger sister under lock and key.
Yeah, lucky for Spade, as it turns out.
Indeed.
This also reminded me vaguely of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. Suddenly, I realize there's two guys who are thinking they're scamming.
Oh, yeah.
The woman, and the woman is, she's on top of things the whole time. But
right, she's pulling the strings.
Yeah, and it's wonderful because the final reveal, I mean, in this case, we keep getting revealed. She is, how many onion layers does Miss Wonderly, Miss O'Shaughnessy, whatever her name is, how many layers
Three
of lies?
Three different names.
Yeah, how many layers of lies does she have? So many lies.
We should come back to the question of identity, right? And who is really who and who is really what in this story?
Right. Because we don't, in the end, we don't exactly know either. So Archer goes out to trail him, and then in a very cinematic scene, and it's shown in the movie the same way. Spade gets a phone call.
The scene is not in the book.
Wait, what's that?
Yeah,
the scene
that's
with
true.
The shooting is not in the book. Yeah. It goes straight from Spade getting swooped by Archer to rescue this damsel in distress.
Oh, you're right. He's shot in the movie.
Spade waking up at 3 in the morning.
I forgot. He gets shot in the movie. We see someone shoot him. Oh, that's right.
And I think it actually kind of cheapens it to show it.
Yeah, I like it. I like it not shown.
I think that the scene does some interesting stuff in the movie, but I appreciate that it's not in the book.
It's one of the few scenes in the movie that's not basically from Spade's point of view. There are a couple of other brief moments, but that's the one that's very much not information that he is privy to at the time.
That's right. There's almost no narrative. It's interesting because in the movie, you have to show things that somebody can't see if they're not there, of course, or unconscious, but you don't see very much of that at all. That's a good point. Just as with the book. So Spade gets a phone call and Archer's dead. He doesn't seem very upset about it. He goes out, gets dressed, goes out on site there and finds Sergeant Polhouse and sees where his partner had fallen down through a fence and tellingly doesn't want to go look at the body.
No, but this is one of the first instances that maybe the second instance in the book of Spade as a kind of Gary Stu, the male version of the Mary Sue. James, you mentioned, was it James you mentioned this in an email?
Yeah, I did, I think.
Yeah, right. And this is something I had in my notes too, where he susses out immediately the physical trajectory of the crime, of Archer's murder. And we're just meant to believe that he's kind of intuitive about that sort of thing, and he can put all the pieces together, and we get this Spade can do it all, Spade knows it all impression.
So do we think he knows who did it at this point? I mean, does he solve it in his head? Not quite that early.
No, okay. Not at all.
I think he assumes that Thursby did it at this point. I mean, I think that becomes clear later.
Oh, that's true. It gets complicated quickly, but yes.
Yeah, because in all the details.
I will point out one weird thing that's in the book that I think addresses this question. It's in the book. It's not in the movie. He goes to the crime scene. He calls Effie Perrine, his secretary, to have her break the news to Miles Archer's wife, Iva, because Sam doesn't want to interact with her. He's been having an affair with her.
Exactly.
He goes back to his apartment. This is in the novel, not in the movie. And he says to the heir, "Damn her." And it's not clear which of the three women in the novel he's talking about. But he seems to have some sort of inclination that someone, probably Wonderly / O'Shaughnessy, is not playing straight. It may just be that he blames her for putting Miles in the situation that resulted in his murder, and doesn't necessarily blame her for it directly. But he has this moment of realization. He knows it's connected to her somehow.
Yeah, I think it's that he is frustrated to learn that his initial apprehensions or his initial intuitions about this woman being full of it have indeed proven true in almost the worst possible way. It's, this is going to be hard. We knew that her story was very fishy, but she paid a very good day rate.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right. $200 was in. Yeah.
Yeah. And now I'm going to have to repaint the windows.
That's the coldest thing.
I think he was kind of excited about that.
Yeah. Although we should. After he says "damn her," it's because he's letting in somebody from the street, and he assumes it's. And as you point out, we don't know which of the three women he assumes is showing up, but most likely Archer's widow, the immediate widow, she's the only one who could know. She and Effie would be the only people who know where he lives, ostensibly, unless they were following Bridget O'Shaughnessy was following him. And it turns out to be two police officers, not necessarily his favorite thing to happen, and one of them, the lieutenant, starts to pursue theories about how Archer might have been, Archer was getting two-timed by Spade, and he didn't go to see Eva after all. This is where it gets complicated. This is, I think, the plot about Eva was dropped kind of because we get Effie later the next morning saying that, you know, and he giving her a lot of praise for being a detective, that she checked and that Eva had just clearly gotten back and taken all her clothes off and then redressed in a robe to receive Effie.
Right.
Which means that she might be out there, and that's a red herring, but it's interesting how detailed that, and it, the book elaborates on it slightly further too. I think they have more dialogue about it later. But the fact that he goes in there and he's just like, yeah, I get them to take Spade and Archer on and have redo the doors. Like, oh, cold.
Yeah. So yeah, we're given Lieutenant Dundee as his kind of police antagonist, which feels to now like such a type, the police detective as roadblock. And we're meant to believe that they have this history, this antagonistic history, though, you know, we're given no background of that. This speaks to what you were talking about earlier, where Spade, feels like a whole world has been built around him. It all feels very whole, but so little was made of that world and in later works.
Yeah. Yeah, well, he's part of an entire city ecosystem, right?
Right.
We end up seeing him talking with the DA, with these police detectives, with the house detective at a hotel, mm-hmm. with crime scene guys. Like, he's clearly a very known individual, and he has working relationships with all of these people involved in law and order in the city. I like the sense that he is a very important part of daily life in this town, even though ostensibly he's just some schmuck private eye who mostly spies on, you know, husbands who are having affairs.
Yeah. And I do enjoy his answer to Thursby's question of why Miles was, or not, sorry, his answer to Dundee's question of why Miles was trailing Thursby for the swell reason that we had a client who was paying good United States money to have him tailed.
Right.
Yeah, there's all these descriptions. Just looking, like, this isn't where Dundee later slugs him, too, which is a good mm-hmm. bit. But
I was going to say, that is one of those really good points where he leans into his reputation as a purely mercenary character, mm-hmm. which, as you know, spoiler alert, at the end, turns out not to be entirely true.
Yeah, you can't tell exactly how much he's looking out for himself versus how much he's putting out the impression he's looking out for himself versus how much he knows he'd get caught if he went over the line, right? So you're never
right.
sure if he's trying to prevent himself from getting framed. You know, he talks to the fat man about that with Gutman. A fat man with his name Gutman.
Gutman, I know.
That's
very
on the nose.
All right, gentlemen, back to the plot
back
summary
to the plot.
Here.
Thank you, Dylan.
So Floyd Thursby has also been murdered.
Yes, which is, I'm sorry, right, we missed this point, right. So there's two dead bodies already, there's three women, there's two detectives, and Sam Spade sorting it all out. So he goes back in the office the next day, gets the name replaced, deals with Eva, who already wants
his whose facial prettiness was perhaps 5 years past its best moment, the novel tells us.
Yes.
I have that in front of me, it's just so mean.
It's cold, but it's one of those descriptions that it's harsh, but you understand exactly what he means.
A blonde woman of a few more years than 30. So old in those days, obviously.
Yes. Mm.
Being 33 or 34.
So she's there in the office. And she is clearly grieving and also confused, doesn't understand what happened to her husband, throws out the suggestion that maybe Sam killed Miles so that they could be together. And Sam, of course, can't really bring himself to tell her, no, I do not want that.
I do not actually want to be together with you.
Yeah, he is already trying. I mean, that's the thing, that's part of the history we don't know, is he's obviously already trying to extricate himself from this relationship or never wanted to get that serious. And now it suddenly crossed this line. She thinks he may have done it for her. He's, you know, he's trying to get out of the way there.
Yeah.
Oh, man. And then
goes to her hotel. She has left a forwarding address to Los Angeles, but then he gets a message from Effie saying that she's at the Coronet Apartments.
Yeah, so she has thrown out a false trail should somebody be following her, but has passed on a discreet message to Sam through his secretary to ask for her her next pseudonym at a local joint as opposed to out of town.
Miss LeBlanc.
Miss LeBlanc. Yeah. So Miss Wonderly is now Miss LeBlanc.
Right. And then he says, is your name Wonderly or LeBlanc? And she says, it's really O'Shaughnessy, Bridget O'Shaughnessy.
Right.
Of course it is. Naturally.
Yeah. So he goes to see her at the Coronet Apartments. And she gives him an indication, of course, that everything is not as it seems, which he already knew, as he says to her, we didn't exactly believe your story. We believed your $200. But she won't tell him really what's happening.
Yeah, she goes through a lot of fidget theater.
Yeah, yes.
And you have to believe me.
These great descriptions of her going around the hotel room, adjusting things nervously like a hummingbird and going through all these, oh, I'm helpless. You're the only one who could help me. And he, of course, watches all of this with complete neutrality and then calls her on it.
You going to straighten everything and stir the fire again? Or
mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and she plays that card without any real prompting. She's clearly trying to manipulate him and maneuver him into this role as protector and go-between.
Yeah, she's a grifter.
Yeah.
And it's clear at this point there was no runaway sister, that she was Floyd Thursby's associate in some way for some caper.
It's not clear yet. She's such a grifter. I'm not even sure yet, or even at the end, if she really knows when she's telling the truth, because she just tells so many sequences of lies. And he's like, all right, what part of that's true? He's like, some of it. All right, most of it not. And then, all right, go wave after wave. I feel like Gutman is probably, we'll get to him, but he may be the only, he's not reliable, but he's a much more reliable character than he's lying also. We never know there's a nature of truth here. We never know exactly what is true because we don't. All we know is the bird. The bird is the only thing that's at the center, and the bird turns out to be false, right?
The Gutman, above other characters, does seem he does seem more willing to put his real motivation right out there on the table. I just want this thing. I want to pay as little as possible to get this thing that I want. That's what I want.
I will pay a lot, but I don't want to pay more than I have to.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and then I mean
because. The interesting thing about Bridget's truth is that when you peel it all back, the fundamental truth for her is that she's just a crook who wants this, you know, to make a lot of money. I mean, it's not a very complicated truth once you actually peel back her wave after wave of false information.
Right, and she's mostly in danger because she keeps betraying people or worrying about being betrayed going into a situation. Yeah. So in the book, he next goes to his lawyer, who recurs a bit, and he doesn't show up in the movie, and it's kind of almost unnecessary. It's like a little palate cleanser. But then we get to
Joel. He gets him on the phone. Yeah.
Joel Cairo shows up at his office. And this is such a wonderful scene in the movie. I mean, we'll talk about the movie more specifically.
It is.
I love the actor so much. The book, it actually reads as well, too. And it's so offensive and yet perfect, right? It's this betrayal. They're trying to talk about homosexuality without mentioning explicitly. So it is all these dog whistles and kazoos and signifiers. But at the same time,
the dog whistles are much louder in the book, obviously. Yeah,
and in the book, his secretary outright announces, this guy is queer.
Wait, no,
and,
no.
And later, Sam refers to him as the fairy.
Wait, now, wait a minute. It's true, but is this guy is queer? Did queer mean gay in 1931? Was it code then?
It's 29, yeah.
29, yeah. And it... I think if you look it up, it's one of like kind of the OED, when was this first used this way kind of thing. People, a lot of sources say 1932, but come on. I think that it was probably in circulation with that meaning in the late 20s.
Right. You know, what's funny.
It's like the Cary Grant, I've gone all gay all of a sudden and bringing up baby when it's like,
gay. Yeah, that's why.
Officially, it was not necessarily known as a homosexual, you know, a synonym, but like, yeah, it was right around that time. So clearly, you know, conversation was up to speed with that.
It's easier in the movie.
Even without that, the ice cream sundae of symbols of his queerness does not need the cherry on top of the word.
Right.
Yeah.
By the time we get to that.
His gardenia scented business card.
Yeah, that's in the film. Story, he's described as wearing quite a great deal of jewelry,
He has fawn spats.
Fawn spats. He has round legs.
I love the
mincing, bobbing steps
in the movie.
A high pitched, thin voice.
Yeah, in the movie, all they had to do is give Peter Lorre a perm, basically, or some brilliant hair, and that was it. It's like, all right, well done. And the gloves, right?
Also, in the movie, he does this thing with his cane.
Oh yeah,
where he basically fillets it. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. It's subtle, but it's not really that subtle. It's just kind of quick.
My goodness, missed that.
And I think that's kind of like Peter Lorre saying, I'm playing this character in a censored movie, but I'm playing him with the full knowledge of what he was in the source material. So he's trying to give us as much as possible.
I mean, on the subject of queer encoding, there is one interesting language note, which is the phrase gunsel.
Appears
in the movie and in the book. It is nowadays, and partially because of the story, taken to mean somebody with a gun, a hired heavy. But its original connotation was very explicitly a Yiddish word for gay.
Right.
It's essentially a synonym for male homosexual.
It's like a synonym for another word we don't use anymore, catamite.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, very explicitly so. But
1920s twink.
Exactly. When Tammet was writing for this particular short story anthology that the novel was serialized in, the publisher was very much into clean publishing. So that's why there aren't a whole lot of direct bad words. But Tammet was confident that the publisher would not catch on to a coded slur like gunsel. So it is thrown at one of the other characters in the book, who is somehow too mincing or doe-eyed for Sam to like him.
Oh, this is wonderful.
So on that note, what I love about that story about the short story publisher is that, because I looked up at some point in the novel, he mentions that somebody's on the Gooseberry Lay. And that I was like, what does that mean? And that's apparently hobo slang from the time for stealing clothes off of clotheslines, off of like laundry lines in the backyard.
Yeah.
But in a short story, he put that in knowing that Gooseberry Lay sounded to like the people who were not in the know sounded much more, I don't know, much more gay than
like a
gunsel.
Sex act.
Yes, exactly. Like it was a sexist. So he put that in. The publisher struck out, you cannot say on the Gooseberry Lay, but let gunsel slide. So he managed to smuggle in the actual gay slang by putting up this like fake, it wasn't a fake slang, but like this slang that sounded much more overtly sexual than gunsel. In the novel, he gets to put them both in. So
I've been looking this up. I'm a big fan of Yiddish. My family's Jewish, and I did not know this. It's from Little Goose, which makes sense because the word I didn't know was fagala, which is what my grandparents used to politely refer in their version of what is a respectful way to refer to relatives in my family who are gay. They would say a fagala because it was to them polite, but it means little bird. So I didn't know that there was also the word gensel, which means little goose, young goose. How fast?
Yes, yes. I hope we'll come back to this. I like to kind of draw a circle around the three male characters in the novel in particular that read as queer with varying degrees of certitude.
Mm-hmm.
The three women that Sam navigates between, sometimes literally physically navigates between, and the three kind of law and order characters, which are more minor characters, the two policemen and the DA that he engages with, this trio of trios that kind of define poles in the story.
That is very good literary analysis. Thank you for that. That's really, it's great.
Well, we'll see if we come back to it, if it's any good. But it's
interesting. There's so many characters. This isn't a Russian novel, but there's a lot of, I mean, there are so many relationships in this book, which is unusual in my remembrance of how the kind of hard-boiled fiction works, is that there's a lot of stuff and the people get killed. There's tough guys. It's like, this has a lot of different people in it and they all have prior and current interactions. You know, the way that Polehouse is sort of the sergeant is trying to protect Sam, but at the same time knows he's not going to put himself exactly in the line, but then he does without realizing it before Sam sees the DA. All right, we better breeze through the rest of the. It's such a good. I mean, this is such a good story. Why not spend time with it? But so we get Cairo.
Joe Cairo alerts him to the existence of a thing called the Maltese Falcon,
yes.
The black bird that is of great value, and Cairo will offer him an extraordinary amount of money. In exchange for delivering it.
Which is worth a lot of money. That's a ton of money in 1929.
It's like $70,000 today.
I just love the whole scene. It reads so cinematically in the book and then the presentation where Cairo gets the gun. That perfect bit, the thing that I like best in this movie is when Cairo, given the gun back, turns it on Spade again, and Spade kind of shrugs. Bogart's presentation is great, but even in the book, I'll be damned. He laughed in his throat and said, all right, go ahead. I won't stop you.
I won't stop you.
It's so perfect. Yeah. But that Cairo is actually an honest within the context of that he doesn't then just shoot him or take retribution. He's like, I have a thing I have to do, and now I'm going to do it now that you give me the means to do it again.
I really need to search your office just to make sure it's not here.
No, wait, can I guess one thing here too, just because I don't have perfect clarity about everything. At this point, Cairo is acting sort of for himself, claiming to be an agent, but he's not an agent of Gutman's at this point. He's an agent of
on behalf of the figure's rightful owner, which we can assume is not true.
My read wasn't Cairo hired by Gutman to steal the statue, but then decided basically to keep it for himself.
Agent. Yes.
Yeah.
And
that is the impression.
At this point in the book, we have one of the weird, we're introduced to one of the really strange elements of the story. Cairo says he's there on behalf of the rightful owner, some unknown person who has a more valid claim than anyone else's. And Spade says, what about his daughter? And Cairo says, with a red face, he gets all angry, he is not the owner. And we have no idea referring
because
to.
He's assuming O'Shaughnessy is the daughter of the owner.
Maybe so.
Maybe.
It's just odd throwaway thing.
Doesn't she intimate that at some point?
It's really odd.
Spade is being tailed by a young man all over the place.
And he's on his way to the Coronet Apartments to see Bridget O'Shaughnessy. He shakes the tail.
And then has a long conversation with her, introduces that he's seen Joel Cairo.
She asks, can I buy you with my body?
Which is not in the movie, but implied.
Nope. He is the initiator in the movie. She is the initiator in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
In both, though, he's kind of tepid at the prospect.
Yeah. Right.
And like, yeah, I mean, you are stunningly gorgeous. I guess I would consider having sex with you.
But two men are already dead, though.
The things I do to keep up my front.
He's got that in mind. Yeah. He knows that two people have already been killed and unknown others. I think he's already quite dubious about her.
On the other hand, she is made of flesh.
It's true. I love, this is where he has a great discussion. I think this is a crux in the book, too, is that she asks him to trust her, and he's like, what have you ever done? Like, I barely know you, and everything you've done has been a betrayal over and over and over and over again.
Yeah. It is one of those great distinctions between her and, like, Cairo, who insists on searching his office to ridiculous extremes. Is it like, he doesn't even pretend that he trusts Spade, or that Spade should trust him, for that matter, and neither does Gutman, neither does anybody else, but, like, her whole thing is like, no, you should trust me. I can't tell you anything, but, you know,
and
let's
he
trust
says
each
to
other.
Her, he says to her, you've got to convince me that you're not simply fiddling around by guess and by God, hoping it'll come out all right somehow in the end, which sounds a lot like a writer talking to himself. Like, I got to figure this plot out somehow.
Metafictional elements. Is that what you're saying?
I should say Spade is trying to put the two of them together because he knows we're all after the same thing now. So can we figure out what's going on here by putting them together in the same room?
But I gotta interrupt 1 second too. Is this, I completely blanked out on this thing where Spade tells this long story about the guy in Seattle and running
the
off and starting
craft, flitcraft.
That is an amazing little story. Holy cow!
It's so
it is
great.
An amazing story.
Yeah, completely elided from the movie. So I think it's worth reading the book just for that little philosophical short story about how people deal with the possibility of death and what they will do to adjust their lives.
And the question of is change possible? Going back to something you were saying earlier, Glenn, like if a novel is supposed to show change and progression over the course of a story, does that happen here? I think in the middle of the book is, and it's not the middle, in it's, you know,
the first
somewhere
third.
Buried in the book is this story about the nature of change and whether it's possible.
Right. People have in spades telling, people have an essential nature that does not change regardless of circumstance. Yeah. Even an amazing, shocking event.
It might be temporarily disrupted.
Yeah,
but
they consciously think of it as disruptive. They end up settling back into the same routine.
I love this line is, he adjusted himself to beams falling, and then no more of them fell, and he adjusted to them not falling. Oh, it's such a brilliant, it's like the best philosophy. It's true. It's true. We all know these moments. So he gets Cairo to show up, and they're talking about who killed who still, and there's more. Then we get into a lot more
detail. There's some reference to a fat man.
Yeah, we get detail about
content. Do learn that Bridget O'Shaughnessy will have access to the Falcon in about a week, and that Cairo will fork over the money if she will fork over the bird.
Right.
And that she and Floyd were involved in hiding the bird. And that is why she doesn't have it right now, is that he had made arrangements for it to be sent on.
Right. Although we find out later, of course, that's a lie.
Everything's a lie.
It's true. Nothing she says
everything
is true.
Everything she says is a lie.
Yeah.
But as they're, women. as Joel and Bridget are exchanging verbal and then physical blows about a boy that he, quote, had in Constantinople and she could not make, the cops show up.
Right. There's a lot of cops showing up at apartments in this. There's a lot of people showing up. I mean, I realize it's the trope of the detective novel, but there's a lot of people being moved from place to place, and business are getting everyone in one place, and then more people show up. Then there are guns drawn and guns put away. This is a.
Well, it's clear that the police have their eye on Sam for this crime. They keep showing up to hassle him.
And
he has motive. I mean, like from their perspective.
Well, from their perspective, right.
For the Archer murder, at least.
At least for one of them. And so we're not at this point told why, but here again are Dundee and Polhouse saying, we'd love to take a look around. And Sam is not inclined to let them in, certainly not without a warrant. But then from inside his little apartment comes a shriek from Joel Cairo, help, police help. And okay, looks like we're going in. They go in, they spin this yarn about their relationships, Cairo, O'Shaughnessy, and Spade. The police seem to still want to take them all down to the Hall of Justice, and then they try to play it off as a joke. I find this section...
At Spade's instigation, yeah.
Yes. I find this section really tiresome, this section of the novel. I read the book twice in a row for this, and the second time through, I just was like, okay, flipping pages. This is really boring. This is really tiresome. I don't believe it. You're just trying to move the plot along in a certain way, and this is the best you could do.
Well, it's also a serialized novel, so there was some padding out just to make every installment the right length and to have it run for as long as it needed to.
I got a word count I have to hit here.
Well, and that, you know, I set myself up with a cliffhanger and now I have to write myself out of it. And this one was not the most elegant solution.
Oh, it's almost like he's
purely
fiddling around
functional.
It's almost like he's fiddling around by guess and by God, hoping it'll come out all right somehow in the end. So they get the police to kind of back off a little bit, but we learn that they take Joe Cairo in with them.
Well, I like this little betrayal too, where she's thinking about leaving. And she wonder after they take him away, or he goes off with them, and O'Shaughnessy asks him to look if the kid is still watching.
Oh,
yeah. He goes out, and he's not there, and he comes back and just says he's still there. It's just these casual betrayals. Oh my goodness!
And this is the point in the novel where they physically consummate, let's say, their relationship, which is taken out of the movie entirely.
Right.
Yeah.
And then as she is sleeping in post-coital bliss, he goes off and searches her apartment.
Which is also, again, taken out of the movie.
Totally
entirely.
Not in the movie.
Now, this, by the way, catches us. This whole thing takes place over 5 full days and the morning of the 6th day. And we are just now getting to the 3rd day when he searches her apartment. That's the morning of day 3.
I like this. I just want to read this one description because I had to spend some time when I read the book trying to map what he was saying to people's bodies. So he wrote, "She put her hands up to Spade's cheeks, put her open mouth hard against his mouth, her body flat against his body." And I'm actually like almost wanting to draw out because I'm like, wait, her mouth is up there, his hand, the body. Like, okay, now I got it. And we move on. But it's just
there's a lot of choreography.
Yeah, there's a lot of
description
there.
Some of it's sort of clumsy.
Right. And I just love, so he goes and he ransacks her apartment very lightly and makes it clear that it's obvious. It looks like someone broke in, even though he had the key. He comes back, makes her some breakfast.
He does along the way. He finds a week old receipt for the rent for this apartment that supposedly just moved to the day before.
So another betrayal that he's aware of.
Yes. And then he goes to the Hotel Belvedere to look for Joel Cairo.
That's a nice
And Joel Cairo has one of the great, I just love this line, "Our conversations in private have not been such that I'm anxious to continue them."
Yes.
But there's also the wonderful bit
every time we get his ass kicked,
Yeah, exactly. We get popped in the jaw.
We get the bit. I love these hotel detectives, too. It's just such a wonderful feeling of the era, too, with all these guys all know each other. They know Spade. They're buddies, and everyone's like, "Hey, shame if that happened to Archer." He's like, "Yeah, yeah, it's too bad. But look, come over here. Take a look at this guy."
Guns in his pockets.
Yeah.
Oh, this is also the scene where Sam refers to Joel Cairo directly as the fairy.
Right, right.
Whee!
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he's got little spells and dust and sparkles coming off of him. Nope, we're pretty sure we know what that means.
He says that to the
Gunsel.
We know ultimately is Wilmer and has
Wilmer.
Although we never are entirely sure what the relationship is between Wilmer and Cairo, right?
We are never entirely sure. That's
right.
Correct.
At this point, he doesn't have one with Cairo, right?
Well, no. Well, does he? They have some.
Well, we don't know.
We have not yet met Gutman, and we don't know what the what Wilmer's deal is.
But we know that Gutman exists. I should say that Sam knows that Gutman exists based on, in the novel, the G in the air, in the movie, the reference to the fat man. And I think we're meant to believe that Sam, at this point, is kind of putting together that this fat man and this kid with the guns may be connected, and everybody knows everybody else.
Yeah.
Right. So they see Cairo. He wants to talk. They won't do it. Sends Cairo off, and then... checking in with more. There's a little follow-up to the thing that's in the movie where he loses Wilmer, who's following him earlier. He rings a bunch of bells in an apartment building. Someone buzzes him in. He goes through out the back. And then in the book, it explains, it's like he sees a story in the paper that someone's young woman's apartment was broken into, and it's the one that he was at. And he's like, oh, the guy looked for all the women with their names by themselves and broke into each of them. And I'm like, oh, that's a logical explanation. I like that. He was thorough, at least, right?
And in the movie, that actually is explained much more compactly.
Yes. So then we get to the next bit where he makes an appointment with Gutman.
He also sends Bridget O'Shaughnessy. He sends Bridget O'Shaughnessy to go stay at Effie's because Bridget is scared because someone has rifled through her apartment. We know that to be Sam Spade. He says, okay, well, you can go stay with Effie for a while.
Right, which I love that he sends off.
Effie is the best person on earth.
And she just takes it.
Effie
she's
and her
sure.
mom, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, not knowing That's anything about this witness. Woman. Well, she's got intuition that this woman is okay because I think it's sort of sad. It's like Effie is actually pretty bright and she gets taken in and then Sam rubs it in her nose later. Not a good move with Effie. But so he makes the
appointment. But yes, he does make the appointment with Gutman. Sorry.
So we're probably, yeah. And then... right, and it turns out that...
she's called the cops.
Mm-hmm. Because she's trying to make trouble for him because she thinks that she ran to him when he was going up with Bridget O'Shaughnessy, so she assumes he's two-timing her with this woman.
In the novel, Sam says something that I think kind of encapsulates his whole attitude toward the story world. He just says, "Jesus, you women." That's kind of him in a nutshell.
He says mildly is even better.
Mm.
But now we get to finally meet Gutman, who, and we're halfway in the book now. We're past halfway.
About halfway, yeah.
And he is such a wonderful character. I've forgotten seeing the movie because I saw the movie before we read. I was thinking, didn't Sydney Greenstreet overplay this a bit? It's sort of such a broad
character. Nope.
No, it's exactly drawn.
No, he does it perfectly.
Yes.
He just takes it right off the page.
But all this, I like a man who, a man who, yes, sir.
Nobody can talk about that character or Greenstreet's performance of that character without slipping into an impression.
Well, Sidney Greenstreet's such a wonderful actor.
Yes. But it's infectious because it is so perfect and so distinctive.
Yeah, it's really he and Peter Lorre as Joel Cairo seem to combine character and person so perfectly in this film.
Well, and they were cast in, I believe, 9 movies total together. So they basically became a comedy duo.
Right. It was a buddy act.
Moving on. So we have this whole discussion where Guttman avoids telling him too much, but serves him a lot of drinks and tries to, you know, set things up the next step, find out what Spade really knows. And then I love the Spade getting fake angry, which I assume is my assumption is he wasn't really angry. I mean, it's sort of told look, this is all a plot or all an attempt.
He's acting. And the film really makes that clear.
He's a little fed up, but.
Yes. He's leaning into his frustration.
Yes. And he does make it. The movie even makes that clearer that he's acting the part. And also the movie makes it much clearer at this point that Cairo is about to come in and work with Guttman and Wilmer because they just miss each other in a hallway.
Right, which is another one of those other few shots that is information that Spade does not have.
Right. I know San Francisco just well enough that I love when it says things like Spade walked down Geary Street to the Palace Hotel. I'm like, I've been on Geary Street. I've been in the Palace Hotel. That's excellent.
I can see it from my house, San Francisco generally. And this novel actually made me think differently about certain locations in the city.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of the places are still there.
It's just a lovely... Yeah, exactly. It's just a lovely reminder of kind of the durability of the urban fabric. Moving on.
Great bar at the palace, as you well know. Right. So we have a little more lawyer business for no particular reason, right? It goes on. We're advancing plots, exposition. They have a little, banter. And then we get back to the fact that Bridget O'Shaughnessy was lying and or gave him the slip. And even though he rode 6 blocks with her and then watched her for, another several blocks, she still gave him the slip because she's pretty slick.
She got a newspaper, then she went to the ferry building.
Mm-hmm. He managed to track that down, right?
And at this point, Spade once again is met with the gunsel, young Wilmer, and summoned to Guttman. And on the way to see Guttman, he disarms the boy.
Yeah, that was pretty amazing.
Right.
In a scene that is almost explicitly sexual. There are a lot of words like impotent and limp and their physical interaction where he disarms him is so sexual.
His feet went between Spade's spread legs? You mean that's sexual and its implication? I don't know what you're talking about.
I know.
About.
It's hard to believe, Glenn. I know. There's a whole wide world out there.
It's true. In the movie, it's presented very well, but it's a little more bluntly. It just pulls the coat down around the kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's 10 seconds. But in the novel, it really drags on for a while.
Had a Hays code to work around in the movie.
That's right. That's right. So then we get Guttman telling the story of the Falcon. The story that, as you were saying, Glenn, the story that feels like it could be real.
And it goes on and on and on. I didn't realize there was this much detail. I was reading it. I'm like, wait. And then there's another page. And then we're like, okay. Interesting. I mean, it's the rich tapestry of history, but it does crack me.
He was also getting paid a per word rate. So,
I understand that very well.
That's good to keep that in mind when it goes on for 3 or 4 pages.
But the critical factor is that the last owner was this Russian general living in Constantinople. I don't remember the politics of the time while he was there, but there you go. And Kemedov.
Well, it would have been just Wait a minute.
No, it's 29, right? So the fall. Oh, no, it happened how many years before that? 7 years?
This would have been before the fall of the Ottoman Empire. You're right. 17
years. It would have been 1912.
He talked about it being in 1911 and then 17 years, okay. Put it in 1928, okay. Blah, blah, blah.
Right.
There's one thing that's, you know, that we talked about how the movie sort of excises a lot of the subtext and sometimes just text of certain characters being read as queer. But there's something that happens in the movie that I don't think is described in the novel, where Gutman, in this scene, puts his hand on Sam Spade's knee.
Oh, yes,
lot.
Yes.
That actually does happen in the movie as well. Oh. He actually sits down next to him and pats him on the leg, I do believe.
Yeah, he leaned forward and patted Spade's knee. But it seems in passing in the movie, I thought there was an implication there.
In the movie, he's got an interesting cigar placement as well during that. So,
yeah.
But you know, also he has slipped Spade a Mickey,
right,
and is eagerly waiting for it to take effect. Which Sam is, I believe, intent on smoking his cigar.
It's true,
and thus is not as assiduous in his quaffing as Gutman might like him to be. So there's definitely a little eagerness of waiting for Spade
in the
to
movie,
pass out.
In the movie, he does have 3 glasses of whiskey in the course of this.
That can barely
and
affect
Gutman
the
just keeps
pills,
pouring.
Yes. Yeah, I just you have just, to say it too. You have to let me is. Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. All right, and then we move on.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh. Actually, this is interesting. So Spade is still conscious in the book. He's still barely conscious. He doesn't actually pass out when... Actually, he's passed out. It's funny. This is one moment. He's passed out when Wilmer kicks him in the head.
Right.
He rolls over and goes to sleep.
Yeah, that's right. No, he's still
pretty
awake.
Pretty much the only real parts of the narrative that Sam is not directly involved in are, when he's being kicked in the head and in the film when Miles is being shot. Everything else, Spade is front and center. He's really the POV character.
Yeah.
Although it's not presented exactly that way, but I guess we have a super observer view, but it's really him. It's just his point of view.
Yeah, it really follows.
I can't remember. In the book, is there an explanation for why they don't just kill him?
There's not.
Oh, I assumed it was because they weren't sure what was going to work out and they wanted him in reserve in case, because I think Gutman only killed when necessary. I feel like that's kind of a pattern. Like other people in the book are killing more indiscriminately. But I think he may have thought he needed an ally. So they were going to check this out and meet, go to the La Paloma and see if that's where it was at. But if that didn't turn out to be the case, they still wanted him in reserve.
Well, he's Bridget O'Shaughnessy's ally. So if they do anything to him, she might refuse to hand over the bird. And then later on, that he's their ideal fall guy, right? He's a burner.
Right.
Right, because, them a fall guy. You're right. If he's alive, they can blame him on all the murders, too. Which is where he gets his idea, I'm sure. Then the book, there's an interesting bit where he goes back to his office and looks terrible, but says he's fine. And, of course, Effie has a cousin who can confirm all the historical detail, or most of it.
At the university.
Right. So it's a nice little side plot there. But then he goes back to Bridget O'Shaughnessy again, right? And
after that, I think that's when... After he passes out is when
he's
back
goes
in the
back
office.
To,
that's when the Falcon arrives.
Right, he tries to find
Captain Jacoby.
Not
well,
quite.
Jacoby.
Jacoby. There's a lot that happens. This is actually where the movie and the novel most. This is where the movie and the novel diverge most severely.
Mm-hmm.
In the movie he figures out by looking. He wakes up in the hotel where he's been drugged/kicked in the temple.
Right.
He figures out that the shipping news, he goes through the paper, he figures out that La Paloma is coming, and then cut to La Paloma on fire. It's all really fast. In the novel, it's much more spread out. He has a meeting with, he has lunch with Tom Polehouse. And then he goes to the DA's office where he has that great line that's also in the movie, everybody has something to conceal.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to get more backstory on who these people are. Plus the DA thinks he's somehow involved and is trying to pin these murders on somebody. But one way or the other, he figures out that the shipping is key, that La Paloma is involved somehow. Effie mentions in the novel, oh, and by the way, there was a boat on fire. Just like this incidental piece. then one way or another,
well, he's gotten, he's
both
found
novel
the,
and movie.
He's found in Cairo's room, he's found the crumpled up newspaper, and he's reconstructed that. So he knows when she says La Paloma, I thought that was a neat thing, but it's the end of one chapter. So, of course, then you go into the next chapter, all the other stuff happens. We don't cycle back around yet because he's got to meet with Polhouse and the DA. And he has to storm out of the DA's office.
And then movie and novel converge. The plots converge on he's in his office and here's a knock at the door and in comes a man with bullet holes in him.
It's pretty amazing.
And that's there's Captain Jacoby and he drops his package. It's the Maltese Falcon. Suddenly we see this object that we've been talking about, talking around for chapter upon chapter. And there's this great moment that I think is more pronounced in the movie, really, than in the book, where Sam, when they unwrap the Falcon, he's holding Effie's hand. And I think she says, you're hurting me.
Yes, yeah.
And in that moment, there's a little bit of this in the novel too. He seems to have that same glint of all-consuming greed that motivates all the other characters.
Because of course, at this point, Gutman has pointed out that it could be worth millions.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We got the next red herring because God, is she good? Right. Then she calls to get him off somewhere else. So he finds a cab. Well, first he does. This is a wonderful thing. I couldn't remember before seeing the film. I'm like, I know there's a bit where he disposes of the bird in a way that can't be tracked to him easily. So he doesn't have access to it and it gives him and I'm like, but how did he do that? It's like, so he goes to.
Puts it in the mail.
Right. He puts it in the, goes to the parcel room.
He puts the key to the locker in the mail.
Yeah, which is great. Right. So he checks it, he puts the key, and so he knows where he could get the key when he needs it. But right.
Because he has a fake mailbox under the name M.F. Holland.
Which is awesome.
It's Dove.
Dove, I'm sorry.
I mean, they're the same.
And what's the difference?
They're the same bird.
They are the same bird.
I don't think there is a difference. I just realized that this moment. I was thinking, is there any reason why? I think M.F. Holland, same. There's no connection. He's good at names.
Now, this is one of those scenes that really reads as I got to fill out a word count where he goes to Burlingame. He gets a cab and goes to Burlingame.
I feel like going to Burlingame would be a really great euphemism for filling out your word count.
I've been to Burlingame. There ain't much there now either, but
it's full of red herring.
Well, it's complicated. It's a whole complicated thing, right? We have this thing where he checks the bird. He does that. Then he goes to the hotel to see what's going on
in the
Alexandria Hotel.
He goes to the hotel.
Then he sees in the novel, there's the characters not in the movie at all, which is Gutman's daughter, ostensibly. And she appears to be drugged and is keeping herself awake. He seems to have taken care of her. She convinces him that O'Shaughnessy's she's like the secondary, you know. So he's already got the information from O'Shaughnessy, may not trust it. But then, you know, this is confirmation to him that, okay, well, this person can't be lying. We've got this whole other person about to pass out. So then he winds up going down to, to Burlingame to see the address. In the movie, doesn't he pull up and it's like a burned out house? It was a great little.
Oh, there's just nothing there. It's like an empty lot.
Right? Yeah. In this case, there's nothing. Yeah, nothing winds up being at that. The house is unoccupied and empty. So it was just a fake address. And he comes back.
And then back up to the city he goes, and he goes to his apartment, and there's Bridget. And they go inside, and hey, look, it's Gutman and Wilmer and Cairo.
Finally,
oh, how convenient.
The gang's all here.
Well, and the book makes much more clear, or he makes much more clear that Bridget was part of the setup for that.
Yes.
Like that she deliberately lured him back, like gave them time to break in, lured them back there, got distracted him just enough as he was walking in so that he couldn't do anything anyway.
Yeah.
And they don't really hit that point as hard in the movie.
But in the movie, because there's no Rhea Gutman, it's O'Shaughnessy on the phone that gives Effie the 36 Ancho Burlingame address. So either way, she's complicit in pulling him away and then pulling him back.
True.
So Spade gets back to his apartment. Gang's all here. And they have their complicated negotiation, multi-hour negotiation about what can we pay you? We need a fall guy. The fall guy turns out to be young Wilmer. Poor Wilmer.
Poor Wilmer.
Oh, but wait, before we get to Wilmer, I love this whole, isn't the money thing first? Where the money gets handed back?
The 10,000, where he forces Bridget to do a strip search, yes.
Yeah, which is...
Well, the strip search, the search comes later, but yeah, this
is when the
envelope of $10,000 in $1,000 bills...
Comes up short.
It's just, I love that, you know, the movie The Grifters was great because it was just full of, like, the fact that, who was in that? It was wonderful. It was John Cusack, Annette Bening. Angelica Houston. And it was just like it just was like breathing to them. They're like, of course he's going to palm a bill or lie or do whatever. And the fact that Gutman was willing to literally do that, to palm a $1,000 bill to make
to mess with him.
This, we'll talk about this later.
I want you to see what you do, sir.
The terrible...
Pass the test with flying colors.
Oh, yes, wonderful, man. The movie Satan Met... what was it called? I can't even remember the title. It's so
terrible. When Satan Met a Lady.
Satan Met a Lady. There's a bit, we'll talk about it a little more, but where it's not even the Gutman character, someone else, it's the, I think what's supposed to be the Cairo character, but he's an Englishman, hands Shane a $500 bill, and Shane holds it up to a light, tears it in half, and the fellow goes, oh, of course, and he reaches into a different pocket, and Shane says, oh, figured out which pocket the real money was in or something like that. It was just a funny little bit. It's like that was their homage, I guess, to this scene or something.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
By God, sir, you are a character.
You are a character. So we, this all boils down to the point of Gutman agreeing to hand Wilmer over to the police as the fall guy. Which is not entirely inaccurate, given that he did, in fact, shoot Thursby and Jacoby.
They're not exactly pinning it on an innocent victim there.
I love him like he was my own son. If you lose a son, it's possible to get another.
Oh,
but there's only one Maltese Falcon.
What a line. We're not sure. I mean, even at this point, we don't know what's motivated. I mean, you know, in some cases, like the Indiana Jones and the... I never remember the titles of the movie. The one with Christ's Chalice. What is it called? What can I think of that?
That would be The Last Crusade.
The Last Crusade, thank you.
With the Holy Grail.
The Holy Grail. I could use more complicated words, couldn't I? I thought there's something, I mean, in that one you have, so Indy's father is pursuing this object because it's just his lifelong obsession and he's a researcher and the goal is to be the person who finds it and retrieves it, right? In this case, I mean, Gutman is motivated by money, but it's still not clear even at this juncture. It's worth a lot of money, but he's put nearly 20 years of his life into it. And it's not clear why it seized his attention so much. You know, they still haven't, I feel like the bird is supposed to be a symbol, but I'm not sure they ever established even by this point why it has such a pull, but it does.
The search for the bird, the greed for the bird is what makes this story to me read like an urban version of The Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
Oh,
sure.
Also adapted by John Huston from a novel written in the late 1920s, also starring Humphrey Bogart. Yes, but aside from all of those superficial similarities,
wonderful.
It's really a story about greed and covetousness and how it works on people and how, in the end, both we and the treasures we seek are ultimately rendered into dust.
And interestingly, in this one, the Bogart character passes the test more or less. He is tempted, but he does not fall.
Oh my gosh, you're right. He chose
overwhelmed by greed. Sorry, yeah,
he chose wisely, is what you're saying.
He chose wisely.
That's right.
But a few
sleepless nights, maybe. But yeah,
These are some brilliant observations, I think. All right, let's do the rest of the practical part though, which is we finally get more exposition. I don't know what you call exposition that comes at the end. We get, you know, post-facto exposition.
Denouement.
All right, we figure out, all right, who killed who, what, when did it happen? Wilmer went to his hotel, he didn't go out, he killed Thursby, whatever. And we still don't have, you know, the answer, of course, the explicit answer of how Archer was killed. But things, you know, move along, and then they finally, he puts Effie at risk. Once again, putting Effie at risk, she's selfless. She calls her. She shows up in this room where they could have taken her hostage too. Instead, she hands her the package. He sends her on her way, and she's fine. She really is. Mm-hmm. Effie needs her own books. I think that would be cool.
Yeah.
Forget about this Sam guy. I got my own career to worry about. And then we have the money situation we talked about. Cairo is talking to Wilmer back and forth. He's constantly whispering, muttering until the kid, you know, sort of punches him or pushes him away. Yeah, he made a fist of one small hand and struck Cairo's mouth with it. It was very sad, the whole thing. We don't know what the relationship was. We know that he just wants him away from that moment, too.
Here's the bird. Oh, whoops, the bird is fake.
And I gotta look.
Everybody go home.
And then the Joel Cairo rant that in the movie inspired Stimpy. Or sorry, Ren. And Ren and Stimpy.
You imbecile. Yes. You spoiled idiot. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. But I also love the bit where, I mean, it's a wonderful set of pieces now is Spade lets the, you know, okay, and this is where we diverge from the movie again, right, is Wilmer escapes. Spade lets them leave. We still don't know who Archie.
But takes some money.
Takes some money. And then Gutman's like, sort of, they both shrug. It's like, I love this. Gutman, after a little pause, imitated Spade's shrug and accepted the envelope. And, you know, and then that's it. And I thought that was an interesting little bit of odd respect. But then realizing later that Spade is using that as proof that he wasn't in on it, that he had the money, that he was bribed, right?
Right.
And then we get the final chapter in the book where we get the terrible scene. He goes, I mean, I feel like he's not rubbing her face into it, but he wants her to understand. Maybe he needs to talk it out because it's exposition, but that he won't, he just has to tell her again and again why.
He won't play the sap for her.
Yeah. Pages and pages of telling her, you know, why he won't take the fall.
It's like asking a dog to catch a rabbit and let it go.
I just read the Expanse series of sci-fi books. I don't know if any of you have read those. Yeah. No? Yes.
No.
They're wonderful. And they're wonderful. They're made into a sci-fi miniseries that's got another season coming in 2017 that is also quite good, I thought. But there's an interesting thing is in the first book and then in various forms, which I won't use spoilers to explain later, there's a very hard-boiled detective. He's a belter. He grew up in a colony on Ceres. You know, low weight environment, but he wears a fedora and he has this swagger and attitude of he drinks a lot. He's not exactly Bogart-esque, but there's something about this relentlessness is actually the key character trait. And I realize it's lifted directly from, or not lifted, but it's an homage. This is that, you know, once you put somebody on the scent, they never get off and it's your problem. You started this. They're going to see it through no matter what the consequence may be.
Yeah.
I think we got go ahead.
He confronts, relentlessly. He just pounds away at Bridget all the reasons he is not, as he says, going to be the sap for her. And then here come the police. And he says, here's another one for you.
His entire monologue to her, as taken from the screenplay, was on a giant poster in that room of my parents' house.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow.
It's largely burned into my brain.
What do you think that they were trying to teach you?
Yeah, that is a good question.
That Humphrey Bogart is awesome.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
No, but also it really is it's a speech about ethics as opposed to a speech about morality.
Oh, beautiful.
It's also the speech where, I mean, this is where I love basically that there are fundamentally two twists in this novel. I mean, one is the really obvious one that I think everybody remembers, which is that it's not the real Falcon in the end. Right. Like, you know, it's a lead statue. But the other twist, and I sort of wonder if this is one of the reasons why he never did a sequel with Sam Spade, like why there were not 15 Sam Spade novels. But the other twist is that the whole thing, you think for a really long time that what he is trying to do is figure out where the Falcon is and get the Falcon and solve that. But really, he's been working the whole time to figure out who killed his partner and bring that person to justice.
Well, what do you think would have happened, though, if the Falcon turned out to be real and he got the giant payout? Do you think he would have...
I think he still would have turned it over, mostly because I suspect that this was his plan all along. I mean, obviously, they showed up in his room, but I think that the actual denouement is what he was working toward. And I think that he had no way to know that the Falcon that they got was fake. And in the movie, like, he reacts to it as though it must be real. He has no reason to suspect that it's not a real Falcon.
Yeah, do you think he was hoping to get the payout and find the killer, and then
also possible?
Get that brass ring.
Let me spin you another theory, though. So he's described as Satan Gutman, God man, big man, big guy. Mm. God is dead.
Too deep, Glenn. Too
God
deep.
Is dead. The bird is a sign that there is no. The bird is a sign that there is no morality in the universe. That we live in an empty void. God leaves.
Oh, and this is why Paloma, the dove, burns.
Right, it's the dove, and then
that's the other bird.
Right, the other bird. Aha! Uh-huh. And then Gutman leaves the scene, and we find out in the book he's murdered. Right, we don't. Does not happen, and we don't see it in the movie. It doesn't that's happen. Right. So God is dead.
They leave it open for a sequel.
Right. God is dead. There is no morality in the universe. We are in an empty universe. And then he gives a speech about ethics, as Dylan points out, not about morality, about ethics. So he's providing...
I think that's a great theory for your green text on black background GeoCities web.
Thank you. It just came to me all in a dream. The Gutman, Godman, and the rest. So
I like it.
I mean, because the other reason I think that it makes the most sense for... this to be where Spade was going the whole time is that it plays into what we were talking about a little earlier, the whole Gary Stu thing. He is Hammett's ideal detective. He is, you know, the dream detective, and he has the whole thing figured out. The Falcon itself is not the point. What he is doing is avenging his partner or bringing that person to justice. And that is his motive in this whole thing.
But it's nicely subtle. And most things like this that follow, that's the overt thing. I have to bring my partner was killed. You killed my partner. It'd be said over and over and over again. Here it is not.
Well, and I do want to put the final punctuation mark on the plot in the novel, which is he goes back to the office on the morning of the sixth day. And there's Iva.
Right.
And he still has this.
This is a terrible scene.
He still has.
The scene is so awful. And I mean, like, wonderfully awful is that he comes back and she, you know, he's sent her off to be killed, basically, which is, you know, she committed this crime. Effie, you know, he puts his arm around her waist, his hand at her hip. She did kill Miles Angel offhand like that. And she says, please don't touch me. I know you're right. But don't touch me now. Not now. So his face becomes pale. Then Eva comes in and he says, well, and he said, and shivered, well, send her in. The whole thing is so, it's like, what just happened? It's like all life has drained out. Like the one woman is off to jail. The other is maybe be killed. Effie spurns him and Eva, the one he doesn't even want, arrives. And he's made all these various beds that he's sleeping in.
Right.
Yeah. I do so
much
also
for
wonder,
change and growth.
Yeah. It does also make you wonder that he is overtly saying that, you know, you have to avenge your partner. I wonder if some of the unspoken motive here is that he could have ended up dead in that alley.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, yes. Oh, yeah. Like if he had been the one that, I mean, he was the one talking to her originally, and he himself may very well have been foolish just long enough to be shot.
Oh my God, you could make a Sixth Sense adaptation of this in which he's dead the whole time.
Glenn, you have the best ideas.
I'm going to go, all derivative, but hey, they're still working. All right, well, we've recounted the plot, but I think we should talk a little bit about...
It's only been an hour and a half.
That's right. Yeah. Well, it's a great film. So what do we think about we've talked about the movie throughout, but... the movie, it's simpler. I mean, it's more streamlined. We lose some scenes, a few characters, and a lot of business. But it feels like the movies, the 1941 movie, is an incredibly authentic adaptation of the feeling of this. I mean, down to like the dialogue and you know, scenes being directly taken from the book. But it seems like they did a remarkable job in capturing that.
It was John Huston's first picture directing.
Oh my God. Which is amazing.
Oh,
yes.
I can't even believe it.
Wow.
He had been a screenplay writer before that, and his father, Walter Huston, was a well-established actor, but John had not really gotten a directing gig before, and the previous film he had been on had been such a nightmare, and he really put up a stink about it, so the studio basically gave him this movie to direct. They're like, the last two versions were flops. What, you know, what the hell? Why not? Give the kid the picture. And he really drilled down and just went for a very clean adaptation of it. I think he went back to the source material and said, I'm just going to find the movie that's in this book as opposed to trying to spackle a movie around this book.
Oh, yeah.
I agree that it's very clean. And especially when you look at those other two adaptations that were mentioned earlier, the 31 adaptation and the 36 quote unquote comedy version, which are awful.
Oh, yeah.
seeing
historically, don't try to make a comedy out of the Maltese Falcon.
Oh my!
Yeah, that's
whatever
a good
decade
rule.
You do it in, it's right. just going to be pants.
If it's the 1970s right. and you call it the Blackbird, don't do it then. Nope. Either.
George Segal, Betty Davis doesn't help you even if you have great actors in it.
So certainly, comparing it to those prior two adaptations, it's a faithful and overall really well done adaptation that creates some of the same tone and at least makes you kind of care what's happening with the plot. But, and this is not my knee-jerk reaction to all adaptations, I liked the novel better, more. And one of the reasons I like it more, one of the reasons is that the novel has these little kernels of strangeness and confusion that are interesting to me. Mm-hmm. And the film mostly irons those out in its streamlining of the story. Certain characters are gone, certain subtexts are gone, and it reads as a much more straightforward, however twisty, noir story about solving a mystery. The novel has these bizarre little curlicues of strangeness that may have been intentional and may have just been accidents on Hammett's part. But I like them.
The novel is much weirder. I think that's right. It's much, well, like, I'm a big Borges fan, and I feel like the Borges owes a lot to a novel like this, although I don't think it's his model for all the detective-ish things he wrote. But, you know, Borges wrote, I probably bring him up in every podcast because I feel like he wrote such a great template for how to look at a detective as being, I mean, he was using him explicitly as a detective as symbology or signs of like the unknown nature of the universe and the presence or absence of God. And I feel like some of those elements feel present here. Like, and I was exaggerating for is Gutman God? Well, he didn't write it, you know, Hammett didn't write that purposely, but there's these echoes and weird little bits. And some of it, you know, he went back, oh, let's make him look more like Satan and mention that or something like that. But,
yeah.
But I feel like there's strangeness in it, especially that last scene, which is like the tomb. It's like, oh my God, it's like, did he die or is, you know, he's not going off to the gallows, but did he just die is what it feels like.
Yeah.
That's the movie ends, even though it's serious, doesn't end on such a somber note.
No. Now, Dylan, you gasped when I expressed a preference for the novel. Have I sinned against Bogey?
No, I think it's just that at this point, the film is has eclipsed the novel almost, or just that for people, when you say Maltese Falcon, they tend to think of the film as opposed to the book, or all the other movies or the radio adaptations.
There's like at least two good right. ones. Yes. One is Sidney Greenstreet and Peter Lorre are doing their reprising their roles, in fact.
Yeah, Bogart as well. There's a previous one with Edward G. Robinson.
Is Bogart in the radio play adaptation?
Yeah, I believe it's actually a full cast.
I looked that up. There's some of this stuff is at archive.org, and there's some other internet radio. I'll find the links for the show notes if people want to find the references. I will dig those up. But that's amazing. Yeah, I mean, radio dramas were incredibly – I forget that we did a radio drama episode of Afoot a few episodes ago, and it's amazing to remember that in the 30s and 40s and maybe even slightly into the 50s that they would have been – seen or heard by more people than would have seen any other media, right? So they would have been the biggest thing. And so all of the stars of the time were all in radio shows. Some had recurring roles, in fact, which is fantastic. I want to talk very briefly about the other two films because I don't recommend that anyone should see them.
Can I double back on the film, the 41 film?
Yes,
for just
of course.
A moment?
I'm sorry you didn't get away in.
Because,
yes, please.
No, that's okay. Because I would say that I think the novel and the film are both great. I slightly prefer the novel, but my major complaint, it's not a giant complaint, but I think the major flaw with the movie from my perspective is Mary Astor, who just doesn't work for me. She's too reserved. And I think it's a casting issue. I don't think that she did a bad performance, but that's the one element that in the book feels more real. Whether or not in the book, I could actually believe that Spade felt something vaguely approaching love for her, you know, in the tropes of the time, you know, right. I don't think he's totally, but in the movie that honestly just sort of comes out of nowhere. And there is the justifications he has to put up there for, you know, like, oh, well, you know, maybe we love each other. That's true. But, you know, you're still going down for it. It's like, it doesn't feel like a sacrifice. And Bogey sells the hell out of it because Bogey is amazing in the movie. But I just don't. She's and at 42.
Sydney Greenstreet's first picture too, isn't it? It's like his
and he's 62 or something. Yeah,
he's a stage actor.
Amazing.
The movie to me is sort of an exercise in extremes. There are such wonderful parts to it, some of the performances, and then there are these flatnesses. I think Mary Astor is not great, but also Barton McLean as Lieutenant Dundee. Lieutenant Dundee in the book is all fire and fury, and Barton McLean plays him like Bonneville Salt Flat.
You're right. He doesn't feel like much of an actual threat either, like just as a presence in the movie, the way that
there are these things that kind of deflate the film along the way for me, though there are these wonderful iconic performances in it and some great directorial choices by John Huston along the way. Even though it was his first feature, I think he was kind of he understood the visual language that he was trying to work with.
Yeah, I love in the movie this time I noticed in the scene where they are finally unwrapping the Falcon and reveal it to be the fake, that I noticed that the expression on Bogey's face and the shine in his eyes and everything that's going on there, I'm 95% sure that Steven Spielberg and Harrison Ford copied that in Raiders of the Lost Ark at the end when the Ark is being opened. And it's the same thing because he's got almost the same expression on his face. And it's pretty much the same thing where, because in Raiders, of course, they open it and everybody's convinced that it's not the real Ark because it's full of sand. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's the same sort of, you know, like, oh, let me watch this greed play out on these other suckers sort of thing that works out really well.
Well, I'll come back to the last two films, excuse me, or the films that were made before this. Just out of curiosity, I looked at, I think a couple of us went and looked at little pieces of them. The 1931 movie was the first adaptation, and it's funny. I watched some. You can find both of them in different places online in full, and it's just so flat. I don't know if the script. The parts that I watched were reasonably authentic, but it just felt like I was watching almost like a transplanted English, drawing room drama that they didn't realize was should be film noir, should be in that realm.
The pace was way off.
Yeah, it felt like people standing around delivering lines that they were told to say. It didn't feel like any acting was going on.
Yeah, whatever my complaints about the 1941 version might be about some flat elements. Watching that 1931 adaptation, someone has taken the air out of all of life.
How?
I can't remember who plays Sam Spade in that, but he honestly feels like he feels like he's doing an imitation of Humphrey Bogart 10 years too early. Like he does this fake tough guy voice that is just like it comes across as totally transparent.
I think his name is Leary McGrinnerson.
I went to see a production of here's a very obscure connection. So Bridget O'Shaughnessy in that was played.
Are you
by,
Glenning?
No, it's not a Glenning. This is a obscure connection, not connected to me. B.B. Daniels is the actress who played Bridget O'Shaughnessy in that production. This reminds me of seeing B.B. Newworth playing Lowdown Jenny in a production of Three Penny Opera. My wife and I flew from Seattle to San Francisco, big spenders that we are, long trip, I know, to see her in a production. And because we loved Three Penny Opera, we loved B.B. Newworth. She was wonderful in it. The person playing McKeith had no fire, had no steel, and was completely limp and unconvincing. And we're like, how can you make a production of Three Penny Opera in which the homicidal, psychopathic, killer who is at the center of it that we're all supposed to laugh with is completely – you're just like, and I've had the same way watching this where Ricardo Cortez just had no there's nothing that made me feel like he could, you know, had any energy or vitality. The 1936 film, however, is bonkers. I recommend people try to watch some of it. It's just, they're saying, and the strange scene after so there's a bit where it's Ted Shane instead of Sam Spade. There's a bit where he comes back to his apartment, which is very, musical comedy looking apartment. Everything's been torn apart. All the cushions have been slashed. And the Cairo substitute, it's Cairo. The Gutman character is played by a woman, And Wilmer is her actual son in that adaptation. But so he comes back to his apartment. It's all torn up. And there's the Cairo character, who's a tall Englishman. And they're doing what they're trying to do, comedy. But it's not funny at all because they're still using the basis of the script of the book as a script. So it's completely confusing. There is one wonderful bit, though, in that strange scene is after they do some prop stuff where, like, the guy sits down and there's a spring popped out of the chair. He's like, oh, look at this. The fella's looking around his pockets to pull something out. He pulls out a gun absentmindedly, and the fella playing Ted Shane pulls out a gun with purpose, and he looks at it and says, oh, I'm sorry. Shifts one hand to the other. He puts it back in the other pocket, and the Shane character puts it back in. It's the only thing I watched out of about 15 minutes of that film that was in any way amusing. Boy. But Bette Davis is just terribly miscast.
She is. And, you know, you're talking about they preserved some of the dialogue from the novel. Bette Davis's strategy appears to be, as she recites the dialogue of the Bridget O'Shaughnessy character that is pulled directly from the novel, as long as she smiles while she's saying it and laughs every third line, that makes it a comedy. It's really awful.
It's painful. But what I'm reading.
Pity these poor people who were making film before film noir was a genre.
Yeah.
It was so bright.
One of those things that make you wish that the oral history had been invented in time. Why did we change all this stuff?
Both of the two early productions were
the Horn of Roland.
They were brightly the Horn of Roland. So I guess it was stuffed with gems and then something.
Sure.
But they're so brightly lit, right? These weren't film noir. They were like film blanc or something. Film, I don't know what the right word is. It was so bright, both the films, by contrast. What Wikipedia says, and I believe I read this elsewhere too, is that they made the 31 film, but it had lewd content. I did not scan through for the lewd content. I'm sorry. I don't have the timestamps for you. So we may have to go back and look for the actual lewd. I'm sure someone's ankle was exposed.
For 1931.
Yeah, exactly.
Ankle was exposed.
I mean, it preserves the scene in which Spade makes Bridget strip down searching for that $1,000 bill. But you don't see anything lewd.
Oh, what's the implication
other
that
than
she's naked?
The knowledge that she is stripping.
She takes off her jacket.
Oh, my.
Oh. Oh,
I love the movies.
I think you see her shoulders.
I love the movies where it's seen as an obscene act that a man has removed his jacket and is in his shirt sleeve and tie. Those are the best films.
I did nearly faint when I saw her shoulders, but, you know, other than that.
But so it was
that's just because of your low blood pressure.
The claim is that they made the 36 film because the 31 film got blocked by the Hays production code. So they couldn't re-release it. They made another version, which was the terrible Satan Met a Lady, and then, you know, again, it was thrown, as you say, it was thrown as a bone to John Hughes, and this is what came out. Well, I think we may have reached the end of the history of this. Is there anything left to discuss? We've found that God is dead, the universe is empty, and there's a bird.
Dylan, I'm curious, you know, you grew up, as you did, in the Church of Bogart. What, if you can describe this even, what is your kind of earliest memory of the Maltese Falcon as a thing? How did you react to it?
I can't tell you. And again, it's like saying when did you first have awareness of Christmas? Or it's just not, it doesn't read for me. I can't remember what it was like to not have seen that movie or others of the Bogart canon. I obviously was a child during the era of VHS and when Turner Classic Movies first came on TV. So there was constant access to it. In some ways, it's much odder for me to watch Bogart movies as an adult because a lot of interactions and scenes that I had a functional understanding of as a kid are very different when viewed through adult eyes. So I can pick up on things like gay slander or sexual overtones. Let me tell you, To Have and Have Not is a very different movie when you're not 12. A lot of stuff going on there that you do not pick up on as a virgin in sixth grade. For me, it's always been iconic. We've always had a Falcon replica in the house. It's just a foundational fairy tale for me.
It's It's wonderful. I was realizing that the one thing the film doesn't have, there is no anti-Semitism, or at least overt anti-Semitism that I recognize as a Jew in the movie, which is beneficial given some other films from that era.
One of the few boxes that is left unchecked.
I was carefully researching whether Levantine was some kind of anti-Semitic slur.
Yeah, just Middle Eastern.
Swarthy gentleman.
Yes.
It is a progenitor in a lot of ways. It's a progenitor of the genre, and we all kind of read it now. We all know the symbols. We know that, you know, when a woman shows up in the first act, she has to go off in the second or third. And I think it's maybe hard to appreciate something like The Maltese Falcon, published in 1929, for whatever originality and genre groundbreaking it might have done at the time. But it's useful to at least try to remember that I'm told by expert sources it's pronounced Dashiell. Hammett.
I will never
forget. was really creating something new and interesting here.
Yeah, Superman was created just a few years before that. Batman is around that time, and we get Sam Spade. The archetypes of several different styles of detectives and supernatural beings, I guess, all at once. Well, this has been a delight to talk about this. It's fun to delve beneath the surface, and I forget. I mean, it shows how rich the novel is that we have this much to say about it. And I thank you all for coming on board here at Afoot. So thank you, Brock.
Thank you, Glenn.
Thank you, Dylan.
Thank you, Glenn.
And thanks, James, for joining us again.
I won't play the sap for you, Glenn.
Oh, that's all right. Well,
$5,000 is a lot of money.
Well,
he'll wait for you.
I'll wait for you.
I'm going to go off and find the horn of Roland, I hear, is still extant. So I'll go off and find that stuff with gems. But until the next episode of Foot, I've been and remain Glenn Fleischman, your host. And thank you for joining us.